If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If we don't know our history, we don't know where we've come from, we don't know who we are. So it's such an important part of our identity. And remember, you've got more people of Irish heritage living in Great Britain than you do living on the island of Ireland.
That was Jane Olmeyer talking to us about the history of Ireland.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Earlier this year, a new four-volume History of Ireland was launched by Cambridge University Press. Spanning around 1,500 years of Irish history, from 600 AD to today, the project had four editors and more than 100 historians as contributors. For today's episode, we caught up with one of the editors, Professor Jane Olmeyer of Trinity College Dublin, who oversaw the volume covering the period 1550 to 1730. She spoke to our website assistant Rachel Dinning about the new history and shared some insights into early modern Ireland.
So Jane, you've recently been involved with this rather incredible project to create a comprehensive history of Ireland spanning well over 1,000 years. So to start off this podcast, perhaps you'd like to tell our listeners a little bit more about this and how it came about.
I'd be really happy to, Rachel. So the Cambridge History of Ireland is a four-volume, multi-author history of Ireland from basically the 7th century through to 2016. There are over 100 authors, about 25 chapters in each volume. There's over 3,000 pages. So it really is a very ambitious undertaking. And we began it in earnest back in 2014. So it's something that has actually happened remarkably quickly, certainly by Irish academic standards, given the scale of the volume and the ambitious nature of it.
And you mentioned it covers such a massive span of history from as early as the year 600 right through to the present day. So why, in your view, is it important to have this large collaborative work covering this incredible span of time?
I was going to say every nation needs its history. I think it's really important that you have these very, very definitive, comprehensive histories, you know, sort of at least once in a generation. So the last major history of Ireland was actually done by Oxford University Press, and the first volumes appeared in the 1970s. However, it took them, oh my goodness, 40 years to get all 9 volumes out. So we learned from that, and we said we don't want, you know, if we're going to do it, we want to do it in the generation, we want to do it quickly. So that, you know, we were determined that all 4 volumes would come out at the same time and within a relatively short period, because we really want this to be a window into this generation's thinking about Ireland. And when we're talking about Ireland, we're talking about the island itself, but we're also talking about the Irish abroad, because, you know, the island of Ireland today is, you know, 6 million people, 6.5 million people. But if we look to the Irish diaspora, it's an audience of about 70 million, or up to 70 million people would claim to be of Irish descent. So we're very conscious it's a story of Ireland and the Irish and what it means to be Irish in the 7th century, in the 18th century, and in the 21st century. You know, we're very keen to, as I say, take that snapshot across time.
And this period of history that you edited was, I believe, 1550 to 1730. So this was one of the 4 volumes. So I thought perhaps we could talk a bit about this volume in particular. What is so interesting about this period of history for you?
Okay, the early modern period, sort of 1550 to 1730, that long 17th century, is a very transitionary moment in Irish history. So Ireland was England's first colony. And obviously, England had been colonizing Ireland from the 12th century. But that process of conquest and colonization really was completed in the 16th and early 17th centuries. And so what we're seeing is a period of intense change, intense commercialization. We see the plantation, so also the introduction of Protestantism. We see obviously a lot of plantation going on, intense colonization, not just in Ulster, but actually across the country. And this desire to make Ireland English. So, you know, you need to look at Ireland very much through the lens of westward expansionism. It was an age of discovery, of imperialism, the birth of the British Empire, although at this stage it's a very English initiative rather than a truly British one. And Ireland is the epicentre of that. And it's out of this period that we see the birth of modern Ireland as we would know it today. But obviously Ireland is a country where the events of the 17th century were sort of hardwired into our DNA. And so events that took place in this period still shape identity even in the 21st century. So it's a very important period at so many levels. Firstly, how it defines modern Ireland, but also how it has shaped identity, both of the Catholic community, but also of the Protestant community.
That's really interesting. Would you like to give us some examples of that? What events from this period are shaping the identities of people living in Ireland today?
Of course, Rachel. So say, for example, the Irish love to rebel, and there's a whole series of rebellions against this, the encroachment, if you want, of English rule over Ireland. But the most spectacular rebellion occurred in 1641, when there was a major insurrection that, of course, then became part of a wider conflagration, the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, or the English Civil War. And that event is particularly significant because it began with the murder of a very significant number of Irish Protestants at the hands of Irish Catholics. And it then became an integral part of Protestant identity. And throughout the centuries, Protestant propagandists and polemicists would point to 1641 as this moment when, if you want, the Papist Ireland rose up and murdered their Protestant neighbours. So it was a way that obviously shaped a sense of Protestant or loyalist identity, but also it was used as a whipping, a way to whip up anti-Catholic sentiment at key moments. And it really wasn't until the peace process, which is now 20 years old, that actually Ireland came to terms fully with 1641 and the events of 1641. And this history is obviously written post-Troubles very much it's a product of the peace process. We're now able to approach these events more as history rather than as memory. So the emotiveness has gone out of it and we're able to look at it through a very different lens. But it would just be one example. Other examples would be Oliver Cromwell is obviously celebrated in English circles as a great parliamentarian, a great hero of republicanism. In Ireland, he would be excoriated as God's executioner, responsible for dreadful atrocities that were committed at Drogheda, at Wexford. So that would be another sort of key moment that is very much a linchpin of a nationalist or Catholic identity in Ireland. Another great example would be William of Orange in the Battle of the Boyne. Again, very important for a Protestant a sense of identity when William of Orange, if you want, defeated the Catholic King James II. What people don't want to acknowledge, of course, is that William of Orange was supported by a very significant number of allies, including the Pope, that Te Deums were sung in Rome in support of William's victory at the Boyne, because it was all about defeating the wicked Louis XIV, who was the King of France at the time. But that sort of complexity would have been lost. And this sort of history allows you to remind people that things are never as straightforward as they seem, and to look at our history with a degree of dispassion and distance that really hasn't been possible until relatively recently. And I think this is one reason why this initiative is just so important.
That's a really interesting point, this idea that today you can write about events in a way that's perhaps more objective. I mean, obviously no history of Ireland can ignore the Troubles. How is that dealt with in the Cambridge History of Ireland? I imagine it must be quite difficult to write about the Troubles in a way that's not going to bring up these difficult emotions, you know, on both sides of it, for both the Protestant and Catholic communities.
I grew up in Belfast, Rachel. So for me, what occurred after 1969, it can't be history yet. It's still very much part of our memory. And I think that's the challenge. And my colleague Tom Bartlett is the editor of Volume 4. And I think when it comes to the Troubles, we have to recognise that, you know, that it is extremely difficult to write this with the same degree of objectivity that we can for events that occurred in the Middle Ages, in the 17th century, in the 18th century. So I think we all acknowledge that. And I'm sure that those chapters are the ones that are probably going to cause the greatest sense of, maybe be the most contested, because so many of the protagonists are still alive. And it'll be one of those areas where, people will say, oh, it wasn't like that. Or maybe the archive, isn't complete yet. So I think we're fully expecting for there to be debate and controversy maybe around some of the more the chapters that deal with more recent events, including the Troubles.
Going back to your period, so 1550 to 1730, the start of this period was a time when the Tudors were in power. And I was quite curious to ask you about this, because I was wondering how Ireland, with its large Catholic population at the time, was it seen as a threat to England? What was the sort of relationships in terms of religion between England and Ireland during this time period?
It's a complicated one is the simple answer, as it always is. But you're right. From the 1530s and Henry VIII and the Protestant Reformation, Ireland really becomes a very serious security threat to Protestant England. It's always seen as a potential backdoor to England, especially for the great European powers, first Spain and later France. So in order to secure England, you have to secure Ireland. So the Tudors tried very, very hard to, if you want, conquer Ireland militarily, something that actually is achieved with the death of Elizabeth I. Now, she dies in 1603 at precisely the moment that Ireland is militarily conquered. So it's for the Stuarts and James VI of Scotland and the First of Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales to benefit from the fact that Ireland has finally been militarily subdued. But of course, that military subjection is constantly challenged by rebellions that break out, especially 1641. And then we have a lot of instability after 1688, the War of the Three Kings, and then again in 1798. So you know, the fact that Ireland represents a very real security threat to England is just a reality throughout these years. But what's going on in Ireland is much more complicated, because it's one thing to subdue Ireland militarily. Ideally, you want to try and convert the population to Protestantism, which is the language of England. But there's also a wider cultural agenda here, a desire to introduce the English language, the English legal system, to create a mini England in Ireland in terms of the organization of society. To commercialise Ireland, to transform it from a very unsophisticated, if you almost barter redistributive economy, into one that is based around money and markets. All of this is going on in this period. And obviously, the introduction of English and Welsh and Scottish settlers is part of this desire to civilise Ireland. And when I say civilise, obviously that's in inverted commas, because that was the language used at the time. But it's part of this anglicisation of Ireland that occurs very intensively during this period.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down. And learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it.
Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
I recall in your introduction to the volume, you mentioned this Ulster poet who laments that Ireland has become New England in all but name, which I thought was quite interesting. Was it difficult for people to have a sense of Irish identity at this time?
That's a really good question, Irish identity in the 17th century, because I think people have multiple identities at any point, but obviously during this period, because what you find is Ireland as a nation state, you know, it's been a patchwork of feudal lordships, effectively, with lots of high kings, with lots of very powerful local magnates. So identity tended to be very local, very regional. But if there was an overriding sense of identity, obviously, when it came to Irishness, it was very much, it became associated with those who were Catholic, those who were Irish speaking. But remember, the colonial elite is English speaking, and many of the great Irish lords want also to be seen as great, you know, proponents of Englishness, and people work very hard to be perceived as English. And when I say work very hard, I mean the Irish colonial elite actually don't want to be seen as Irish; they want to be seen as English. And then what you'll have is an influx of Scottish settlers, an influx of English settlers, and obviously the English settlers retain a very strong sense of Englishness, and the Scottish settlers. The early generations retain their sense of Scottishness, but over time they also want to be regarded as English. And that's why this process of anglicization goes into that very sense of, you know, being and identity and mindsets. Now, obviously, that's not everyone. That's the elite. As we go down the social hierarchy, people have a much stronger sense of Irishness. That's reinforced by the Catholic Church and by the, if you want, indigenous or the native bardic tradition, and a very, very strong attachment to the Irish language. Many people in, say, mid-17th century Ireland would have been bilingual or would have been Irish speakers. The English language, you know, is the lingua franca in the sense it's the language of commerce, of the courts, of the church. And I say the church, I mean the Protestant church. But you know, it's a very hybrid society where identity are sometimes confused, very complicated, and people will slip between identities. So on the one hand, somebody like the Earl of Antrim, who is of Scottish provenance, he wants to be heralded as a great Irish lord, not a Scottish one, as an Irish one, but he also wants to be seen as a great English lord as well. And then his followers will follow his example because it's still an intensely, I was going to say clan-based, tribal type of community. So it's not easy to unpick identity. And the other the other very interesting factor is the continental influences that are coming in, and the fact so many Irish people, especially Catholic Irish people, are educated on the continent. And so, you know, that's adding this very interesting ingredient as well.
I was going to ask, actually, when we look at the history of Ireland, in Britain, we tend to focus on Anglo-Irish relations, but what relationships did early modern Ireland have with Europe and the wider world?
Well, do you know, those relationships are very extensive and they're fascinating, Rachel. So in the early modern period, what we find are extensive Irish communities in places like Liverpool and London, which is what we would expect. But you also have very, very vibrant communities of Irish settlers across France, across Spain. But as far east as Prague, we see Irish mercenaries in Russia, in Poland. But then globally, the Irish are very active in the empires of Spain, of France, of Portugal, of the Dutch, and of course of England. So by the turn of, say, about 1650, we have Irish traders in the Dutch and Portuguese Amazon. We have Irish settlers in Spanish Cuba, Spanish Mexico. We have them in in the French Caribbean, as well as in the English colonial world, the North American colonies. But we also find Irishmen across Asia. The founding father of Bombay is a man who was born in Ireland. He's third generation Irish, and he himself may describe himself as English, but certainly his contemporaries in the East India Company would have called him Irish, and he held his Irishness very dearly. A man called Gerald Ainger, and somebody like Ainger would have gone to Bombay and brought his experiences of Ireland to Bombay and colonized Bombay very much as his grandfathers would have colonized Ireland. So I think there are multiple, Ireland's very much a global nation in this period. Two sailors from Galway sailed with Ferdinand Magellan as he circumnavigated the globe. Another sailor, a man called William Ayres, crossed the Atlantic with Columbus when he discovered America. So you really need to see the Irish as a global nation. Now, many of these people are going under adverse circumstances. So when the Catholics migrate, it's often as indentured servants, or they're going as mercenaries, or they're going a lot of missionary activity as well. So sometimes the circumstances under which people leave Ireland, it's not voluntary migration, although in other instances it is.
And also during this time, the population of Ireland doubled from roughly 1 million, which was the highest rate of population rise in Europe, so you wrote. Why was this?
Well, actually, it's because of a lot of internal migration. Something like 350,000 people migrate from England, Scotland and Wales, along with the Netherlands and the Huguenots in France. They migrate into Ireland. So we see a booming population, and we see the emergence of a very mongrel population. Something like 27% of the population of Ireland in the early 18th century are the descendants of these immigrants. So, you know, again, it's very much of a melting pot in this period, as it is today. I think today 20% of the population of Ireland was not born in Ireland, you know. So you need to, you know, there's great continuity over the centuries in terms of both inward migration as well as extraordinary immigration out of Ireland.
I wanted to ask you, whilst you were editing your volume, what was something that you came across that perhaps you didn't know, or you think that our listeners who might not have a great understanding of Irish history will find particularly interesting, or something that they don't expect about Ireland?
I think, obviously, I'm an expert in the 17th century. I learned so much about the history of Ireland. And I think what's so wonderful about these chapters, it's not just the political narrative that they are offering, but there's a whole section on society. And there's wonderful essays about ordinary people. And you know, this is where Irish history, I think, has lagged behind, say, the history of a country like England or Britain, where the emphasis has been very much on social and cultural history. Ours has been on a political narrative. So I think in that respect, there's an awful lot to learn about society. But there's also a wonderful chapter on the environment and the environmental history of Ireland in the early modern period. And I realise environmental history is sexy in other areas, but that's new to Ireland. And I found that chapter fascinating, and how the two contributors looked to traditional written evidence, things like the 1641 depositions or the Annals of the Four Masters, and they combined that then with scientific evidence, you know, historic volcanic activity and, you know, tree rings and all of this in a very innovative way. And I think the other thing that I find really refreshing about these chapters is the way the contributors have engaged with technology and used the fact that we now have a lot of material available in digital form, and developed some very sophisticated tools to interrogate that data, to offer insights that were previously unimaginable almost. And we see that particularly in the chapter on Irish landholding, because Ireland obviously was England's first colony. So Ireland was very, very extensively mapped. And we've got an amazing character called Sir William Petty, who in the 1650s maps the entire country just using chains. But even so, he literally lays down chains to map the country. But his maps are remarkably accurate. And we have those alongside the equivalent of the books, the Doomsday Book for Ireland. So we call them the Books of Survey and Distribution. They give us information on who held land in Ireland in 1640 and again in 1670. So, you know, this very, very detailed data that was previously, this is big data for the 17th century, it was very, very difficult to manipulate and use. But now that it's available in digital form, it's allowed us to really do some extraordinary detailed studies of land holding. And so all of this now is, it has been captured in these volumes. And to my mind, it's really bringing a tremendous originality, a vibrancy, a freshness to a story that we know the political narrative, but this is just really adding to it hugely.
I really like that the volumes do have this social history, because it's so true. People do, you think of the history of Ireland and you think of it in terms of politics and religion. Yeah, would you like to tell us perhaps a bit about some of the social history side of things? What was life for the ordinary person like in this time period, 1550 onwards?
I suppose what I've been struck by is how useful archaeological evidence is in helping us recapture the ordinary experiences, along with evidence like the 1641 depositions, which I mentioned earlier in the context of mass killing and ethnic cleansing. But what these depositions also provide is a very unique insight to ordinary life in Ireland, because they contain inventories of people's homes and of their barns and of their sheds and of their workshops. And so it allows us to reconstruct, if you want, daily life in Ireland. I'm extremely interested in about 500 widows, very, very ordinary women whose voices are otherwise lost from history, and just the extent to which these women operated in colonial Ireland as members, obviously some of them extremely poor, who are virtually living on the poverty line, eking out an existence, often with dependent children. And then others who are working maybe with a father or a brother or a husband in some sort of trade. They're very involved in the rural economy. Others are acting as moneylenders. They've obviously accumulated little cash. And remember, this is an era where there are no banks. And so these widows are operating in local communities, lending small amounts of money to their neighbors and their friends. And they're doing so on the basis of trust. And that's, you know, because there's no way of recovering the debts except through goodwill, because they're small debts. And that's why when the rebellion breaks out, it's so catastrophic for them, because then they've lost, their money is lost and it's not repaid. So you know, you get all of these wonderful, vivid insights into just, as I say, ordinary life. And this is where, again, these volumes help to recapture that. And what we hope is they'll actually encourage much, obviously, further research. No volumes can ever be comprehensive. But if they provide a platform for debate, discussion, further research, then we've achieved something.
I was going to just bring things back to talking about the collection of volumes in general. What I wanted to ask you was, do you think that Irish history as a whole is poorly understood or even neglected in the wider world? I grew up in England. I was born in England. I didn't learn any Irish history at school, which seems crazy to me, given how close it is. Do you think that more should be done outside of Ireland to educate people about Irish history, particularly in Britain?
Well, the answer is, of course, yes. But listen, I grew up in Belfast and I didn't study Irish history until I was 16. So, you know, here I am living on the island of Ireland, learning my history very, very late. So I think there is a major issue. And listen, if we don't know our history, we don't know where we've come from. We don't know who we are. So it's such an important part of our identity. And remember, you've got more people of Irish heritage living in Great Britain than you do living on the island of Ireland. So I think there is a tremendous interest in Irishness and Irish history in Great Britain. So I think as we move into a post-Brexit era, it's more important now than ever to remember the shared history that we have. And, you know, it's not always been easy. So back in 2011, Queen Elizabeth II visited Ireland, and it was a very historic moment. And she spoke very passionately. It's the most political speech I've ever heard the Queen give in Dublin Castle about the past and how it's very important that we bow to the past without being bound by it. But the past obviously has shaped us who we are. And I think it's had a very important, the Anglo-Irish relationship is a very important one at so many levels, especially because of these human connections. So these volumes are being published at a very significant moment and a very sensitive moment in the history of these islands, not just because of Brexit, but because in Ireland itself, we're in the midst of what we call a decade of commemorations that began in 2012. Obviously, then we had 1914, the outbreak of the Great War. Then we had the Irish Rebellion or the what we call the Easter Rising of 1916. We commemorated that with great dignity, I think, as we did the outbreak of the Great War. But we're now moving into very, very sensitive commemorations. The 50th anniversary of the outbreak of the Troubles in Northern Ireland in 2019. And then we come to 2020 with the 100th anniversary of the partition of the island of Ireland and then the outbreak of civil war the following year. So, you know, this is a very, very, very sensitive and significant moment. And I think one thing the Brexit negotiations and the Brexit discussions brought home to me was how little certainly some of the politicians in Westminster knew of Irish history and the past, or if they knew, they just didn't seem to care about the sensitivities of it. And actually, the Irish question is something that is still dominating politics today. It doesn't go away, it just gets reformulated. So I think an appreciation and understanding of Irish history and of Anglo-Irish relations is something that would be in all of our interests too. And that goes on both sides, if you know what I mean. I think it's very important that we in Ireland really understand our history and our shared relationships with Britain and Northern Ireland. So it's very important, and now more than ever, Rachel.
That brings me on to my final question quite nicely, actually. I was going to ask you, do you think that there will be, in, say, 20 years' time, another volume of the Cambridge History of Ireland that might include some of these contemporary issues?
Well, all I can say is I hope so, because I feel that, you know, especially we're living in historic times, and it's very important that these are captured, and maybe it'll be a revised edition of these, or it'll be a brand new multi-volume history of Ireland. Because 20 years, given the pace at which things are moving, you know, things could have moved on very significantly, not just in terms of contemporary events, but also in terms of how we interrogate the past. You know, technology is moving on at a pace that allows us to do much more innovative and creative research, access to the archives, all of this. So I think there's, you know, what you have to see these Cambridge histories at is this generation's take on the history of Ireland.
That was Professor Jane Olmeyer. The Cambridge History of Ireland is out now, published by Cambridge University Press. Okay, so that's about all for today's episode, but we will be back on Thursday to discuss some of history's greatest engineers with Simon Winchester.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.